So welcome to the Fatigue Super Conference. And for this session, I'm talking with Gemma Hunt, who is one of the psychology practitioners at the Optimum Health Clinic, who, like a number of our practitioners, has had different stages to her journey with us, because actually she was formerly a patient. She then did the practitioner training program that we run and then has gone on to join us as a practitioner. We've covered Gemma's recovery story as part of our Facebook Lives, so if people want to go and check out that, they can do there. We'll touch briefly, start off with, just a little bit about Gemma's story, but really what we're going to focus on in this session is the role of the helper pattern in fatigue recovery. So we talk about different subtypes, and we break it down to the psychology side and the kind of physical, nutrition, functional medicine side. And one of the subtypes on the psychology side is the helper pattern. And that's really the place where we are defining our self-worth by what we do for others. And so what we tends to happen is that we tend to burn ourselves out and sustain our burnout by constantly making other people's needs more important than our own. And it could be quite a deep process and challenge to build awareness of and transform and change this pattern. So we thought it'd be an interesting way to explore this would be through the lens, in a sense, of a real story. And particularly for Gemma, someone who's also working as a practitioner, there's different levels to the insights around this. So welcome, Gemma. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So just for people that may not have seen your original recovery story, maybe you could just say a little bit about, just briefly, your story of how you got ill and the kind of journey that you went on with chronic fatigue.
Yeah, so it was November 2014, and I started with a virus and just wasn't getting any better. I was, at the time, I was planning my wedding, which was going to be the January. So I had a couple of months before my wedding, was working for a promotion at work, doing, as well as kind of working full time, I was running a kind of health and fitness thing at work as well. So on lunch times, I'd be taking people out running. So I was pretty busy. And I got a virus. And when I first started feeling grotty, I was like, I know, I'll sweat this out. So I was cycling to work to kind of sweat it out my body and get over it that way. That didn't work. So I took a couple of weeks off work, working from home on my laptop as well, rather than actually resting. And it just kind of didn't go away. And I did go back to work, but on reduced hours for a while, but it just wasn't shifting. I did have my wedding, and kind of adrenaline and alcohol got me through. I wouldn't advise that. And after the wedding, I really kind of crashed. And I was like, what is going on here? You know, I've been like this for a few months now. So I started kind of looking around, trying to get answers, badgering the doctors, but they kind of didn't know what to do with me. And I think it was around end of February, start of March, I stumbled across the clinic online. And at first I was a bit wary, I have to admit. I was like, really? And I was like watching the recovery stories and I was like, is this real? And so I had a 15-minute chat, spoke to people, and I was like, okay, yeah, this sounds good. So I went to the 90-day program in April, and I had some real light bulb moments there where I realized I needed to kind of stop trying to work part-time and actually just take some time for me. So I did that into my journey. 9 months into kind of being off sick, I was made redundant because the company was restructuring and I kind of opted for it. And then I kind of realized, actually, this is an opportunity to kind of do something different. And I already knew my heart wasn't in going back to what I was doing before. So I started on the practitioner course. And that kind of helped me along with my recovery and helped me understand some of the patterns that were playing out, because I had a few. Continued studying. I remember actually when I spoke to you about the practitioner course, I asked you in my initial chat, like, how do you become a practitioner at the clinic? And you obviously gave me a very diplomatic answer back then, because you didn't know if I was any good.
I suspect it was something on the lines of, well, you know, we have like 25 students a year, most people do practitioners, maybe one or two get taken on, so I wouldn't do the course. If that's what your heart set on, that wouldn't be the reason to do the course.
Yeah,
of course.
I think that was pretty much it verbatim, actually.
I've answered the question a few times over.
So, yeah. And I did the course and completed it, and obviously, yeah, along the way have recovered and now kind of living life and yeah, working as a practitioner.
And obviously there were many facets to your recovery journey, and so check out the Facebook Live. And I know that nutrition was an important part of that. There were lots of different pieces to the psychology piece. But for the purpose of this conversation, we're going to focus primarily on the helper pattern. Mm. And one of the things that I think is quite interesting is that initially, you didn't really identify that as being part of what was going on. You could see the achievement pattern. And from the way you've told your story, I think people will be able to see that you were pushing yourself beyond your capacity and your limits.
Yeah.
And of course, at stage one, we talk about three stages of recovery, and I can't immediately signpost where, but it will certainly be covered somewhere in the conference. But at stage one, being the kind of crash stage, it's relatively easy to just say no to everything, right? So I guess even at that point, you were perhaps not so aware of it because you couldn't do the pattern. But yeah, maybe just say a bit about there, where you weren't even identifying the pattern as being part of what was going on for you.
Yeah, well, I remember on the 90-day program, I was like, achiever, definitely, that's where I sit. And I just didn't help her kind of, I just skirted over. I didn't even think about it. And then I kind of took some time out, started getting a bit better, really focusing on my achiever pattern. And then when I started getting a bit more energy again, I started noticing that I was really people-pleasing, and that I was kind of, when I was trying to bounce the boundaries, I found that a lot of the energy I was spending was to kind of please other people or do something for other people. Like a silly example, I have always, when it's friends, families, birthdays, I've always made them a cake. And when I was really ill, I didn't. But as soon as I started getting a bit of energy in the bank again, I was like, I've got to get back to doing that. And I started noticing these things playing out because I'd been paying attention to myself. And I was like, oh, what's this? Is this another part of the achiever? And then it kind of dawned on me, oh, this isn't. This is helper. And I was like, oh God, another pattern. Great.
Well, I think for people that are watching or listening, it's a really interesting point that it's when there's no energy, everything's, you know, you're kind of even a no to taking care of ourselves if someone's that kind of crashed out. But it's really interesting as energy starts to come back and you're really limited in what you can do and you're prioritizing making a cake over being able to have a shower, for example. There's kind of like really like basic things to oneself that are a struggle. But immediately that energy is going into wanting to be there for others. And for people watching or listening, it might not be making a cake. It might be taking the phone call from the sibling that's having a difficult time when you haven't even got energy to talk to your friends in support for yourself. But it's making other people's needs as being more important than one's own needs.
Yeah. And interestingly, when I started seeing that I had a bit of a helper pattern, I noticed that even when, like, I was, because I kind of crashed a few times in my recovery, and I noticed even when I crashed and I couldn't help others, I also couldn't accept help, and I felt a lot of guilt around, well, I wouldn't ask for help, but if it was offered, I felt a lot of guilt around that, and I felt like a real burden. And yeah, actually, like, accepting help was a real challenge for me. It was like you always had to kind of swallow it down and go, okay, thank you. Oh, it was really uncomfortable.
Yeah. It's another clue of the helper pattern, right? That helpers are really good at doing things for others, and they often really struggle when others do things for them.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And then I kind of start to see how much this has been there and just under the radar.
And as you started to recognize it and you were just beginning to perhaps sometimes prioritize yourself or just beginning to change the habits, and we'll come more in some of the deeper reasons behind this, but how do people respond to that? Because often there's a kind of, often we have relationships set up in certain ways and we start to change. That could be quite challenging for those around us.
Yeah. And I had mixed, a couple of people in my life were definitely like really happy that I was finally accepting their help, because obviously I was helping because it made me feel good. And other people like to be able to do that as well. And I kind of took that away from them for a long time. So some people really liked it. Others, it jarred slightly. There would kind of be, almost, you know, when people ask you to do something and there's an expectation that you just will. And then when you say, oh, well, actually, no, they're kind of like, what? You know, there was a bit of shock. And for a while, a couple of people struggled with it a bit. But the more I kind of stayed with it, they adjusted. And actually, they stopped kind of expecting so much of me. And it became, I guess, a much more balanced relationship after that as well.
Yes, yes. I mean, as I know, you know, that the metaphor that I really like is it's like it's a dance of change. And if we're used to being in a certain dance with somebody and then we change the dance, really they have one of three choices. They either try and put us back into the old dance, they come with us in the new dance, or we dance separately. We dance a different dance. And when people try and pull us back into the old habit or behavior, it's not because they don't love us, it's because they do love us. And then they're scared that if we change, they're going to lose us in some way. But it does take a kind of courage, and it takes a certain clarity to see what's happening to be able to break through that pattern. But maybe it's also worth saying a bit about boundaries, because I think one of the things that can happen here as well is that we realize that we don't really have any edges of our needs versus other needs, that we just get consumed by. So say a bit about how that was for you.
Yeah, absolutely. And like you say, the more I kind of started to understand the helper, listen to some of the things on Secrets to Recovery, I started to resonate with a lot, and it talked about kind of boundaries and taking on other people's stuff, and that really resonated. I've always been very good at tuning into what other people are feeling, and you know, that can be something that's really, really helpful, but it can also be exhausting. And I guess tuning into other people's feelings is fine as long as you don't take them on, but I definitely did. If someone else was feeling stressed, I would tune into that and feel their stress. If they were feeling sad, I'd tune in and I'd feel their sadness, you know. And I had emotions of my own that I was kind of working through. And then I'm also feeling everyone else's. It was exhausting. And even the TV, for a little while, I had to limit the TV I was watching, because I would tune into how the people on the TV were feeling. And like, there'd be a sad scene, I'd be sobbing, you know, because I was just feeling it all. Because I just became so good at tuning into all that.
And learning to recognize that pattern and to put in place good, clear, healthy boundaries is of course a crucial process. And you know, for you now as a practitioner, having done that work, I'm sure has been rather important. Otherwise, you'd end up completely consumed by all the people you're working with. And I think it's a testimony to the fact that it really can change. But one has to recognize that they don't have those boundaries and that they need them, and to kind of to put those in place. And maybe it's worth saying a bit about what and it may be it's something we're going to come to a bit later. But what helped you to recognize that, and what helped you to kind of put those boundaries in place?
Yeah, I guess some of the things that helped me recognize it. So working with the stop process and my thoughts was a really good thing to kind of help me see where I was. Because I think we have these thoughts all the time and we're so unconscious of them. And when you actually start getting conscious about what you're thinking, you can see things playing out. And I started to see that, you know, I was taking on other people's stuff, and I was feeling resentful to some people as well. And I started kind of seeing that and investigating, like, what's that about? And I realized that I felt like my boundaries were constantly being crossed. And then I realized it's because I didn't have any. And so one of the things I did was a really nice kind of visualization of like a protective bubble. And I'm just kind of really working with that. There's a few hypnosis on Secrets to Recovery Again, isn't there? And that's something I went back to time and again, and building up this bubble and thinking of it very much as my safe place and keeping other people and their feelings on the outside of it and only having my stuff on the inside of it. Something else I remember someone told me about was thinking about where my energy was. And when they said that, I was like, what? And they're like,
what are you talking about?
Yeah. And they said, okay, just close your eyes and imagine if you had to say where your energy is right now, where is it? And I was like, okay, well, it's surrounding my whole house. And I'm like, okay, so it's surrounding everyone in your house. I was like, yeah, yeah. Like,
and everyone in the TV that's in the house as well.
Absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And they were like, okay, so pull it in to you. And actually, I've found that so effective so many occasions, just kind of thinking of my energy as me and not spreading it out to everyone else. Just a really nice little exercise. So things like this, just really being present with what I'm thinking and working with my thoughts. Looking at my boundaries.
I mean, I think one of the things that can sound so oversimplistic, but I think is really an important piece of all this, as you're talking about, is really boundaries is where is your attention? And if your attention is on everyone else and how everyone else is feeling, that's what you're going to be feeling. If your attention is on yourself and listening to your own body and listening to your own feelings, that's what you're going to be feeling. So it can be as simple as kind of, is your attention in your head and on your anxiety or on your body and on kind of calming your system? Is it on everyone else or is it on your own heart and your own needs? And that kind of shifting of that attention and kind of retraining that focus can be obviously really helpful. But I think it also raises another question here, which is that there's the habitual level, like where are we putting our attention and where are we putting our focus? And then there's the kind of the bigger why. There's like, well, why are we making other people's needs more important than our own? So maybe say a bit about what you discovered in terms of what you were really trying to get through being the helper for others.
Yeah. And this is something I had a lot of help from my practitioner at the time with, because I could see it playing out and I knew I wanted to change it. But I realized I wanted other people's approval and I wanted their love. And the biggest catch of this was that it got me it. Like, it got me, people would love me because I'd make them cakes. People would approve of me because I did nice things for them. But it never felt like enough. And what I realized was it never felt like enough because it was really conditional love. Like, I had to do something to gain that. And I'm sure everyone feels the same. To have unconditional love, that's what we all want. But then taking it even a step further, actually not needing external love because I love myself. And that's kind of where I eventually got to. And it wasn't a quick journey.
Interrupt a second. I think it's important also to make the point, when people hear self-love, the danger of people think about kind of narcissistic famous people that are kind of like, I don't want to be like that. But what of course you're talking about is the kind of something much simpler than, it's not a kind of like, I'm great, I'm amazing, I'm the best, in a kind of like, look at me, but in a much more simple acceptance and love and appreciation of ourselves, not for what we do, but just for the fact that we're a human being and every human is worthy of and deserving of love. So there's a kind of much more, it's a much more realistic and simple and appropriate objective but it's very rare actually that people really have that, unless it's something that they actively realize that needs to be cultivated and needs to be kind of put in place. So maybe say a bit more about some of the things that helped you, like what helped you cultivate self-love.
And just to say as well, like I'm a lot better. I wouldn't say it's there all the time, you know. I still have my moments of kind of like beating up on myself, but I notice it and then I change it to a much more compassionate voice. But yeah, I guess.
So you're saying you're not yet a fully enlightened human being. I'm disappointed.
Not quite. Yeah, but I guess initially it was really realizing how I actually spoke to myself. And that was a bit of an eye-opener for me. Like, I'd heard of the inner critic, I'd done a little bit of work on it, kind of surface level. And I thought, yeah, I'm all right with that. And then I saw it. And I saw how intense it was. And actually, it was just nonstop. And that's why I hadn't realized it, because it's not like it popped up every now and again and I could see it. It was just permanent. So, yeah, really working on that. And looking at where that came from as well, on a deeper level, like, where did I learn to speak to myself like that? So it was some pretty deep work. But then alongside that, there was things like meditation practice, and like doing a loving kindness meditation practice, lots of EFT on my emotions around all this as well, and actually kind of being okay with my emotions. That was quite a learning curve as well.
Which of course is its own act of self-love, right? That when we feel emotions and we reject those emotions, that's an act of self-rejection in a sense.
Yeah.
If you're feeling angry or you're feeling sad or you're feeling grief around something, the very act of allowing that emotion to be there and not necessarily vomiting it over other people, but just letting yourself feel the feeling is its own. That is self-love in action, really.
Yeah, absolutely. So that one took time. I really had some beliefs around emotions to kind of work through, and it was, I got to the stage where I was like, yeah, other people can have emotions, and it was like, well, what about you? And I was like, oh, I don't know. So yeah, it was a real kind of process, and I guess really tuning into how I felt in my body, and really sitting with myself. Because I think it's so easy to be distracted from yourself and how you feel, and your needs. And I think as anyone who runs a helper pattern can be very, very disassociated from their own needs. So actually just really sitting with that and thinking, this is what I need right now. And actually I could give it to myself, and that's okay. You know, there's no judgment there. I'm not selfish. I don't need to feel guilty. Actually, this is what I need now.
Well, I think one of the things that happens when we have these kind of patterns is that we kind of set the world up to support the belief behind the pattern, right? So if we're an achiever, we kind of design our life that we kind of are being valued for our achievements, because that's the kind of people we spend time with. We spend so much energy achieving that when we do, people almost feel awkward not saying we've done well, because we're so clearly kind of looking for that kind of recognition. Mm. When we're a helper, we tend to end up surrounding ourselves either by people that kind of need or want us to kind of help them, or at least people being used to us being in that role. And so there's almost like a kind of confirmation bias that starts to happen, that we start to kind of reconfirm the fact that this is how it is because we set the world up in a certain way. But so that move from kind of doing that to doing something different, it's a little bit like, you know, the analogy that we often will use, as you know, is like being on an aeroplane and it's kind of going down and suddenly the air masks pop down and go, well, I've got to put it on my children first. But if you don't put it on yourself, you'll pass out by the time you've got it on your children. So there's a kind of thing where you have to take care of yourself to then be able to take care of others. But one needs to gather the evidence to demonstrate that that's true. And sometimes also, as we talked about a bit earlier, that the people around us and the relationships that we have, either we change the people in our life or we change the way that we relate to the people in our life. So as you started to make more kind of substantial progress in terms of working on this through the different pieces that you were working on, how was that then received by people around you, that as you started to get more clarity? And, you know, sometimes we can be like a pendulum that swings so far the other way that it's just like, I'm not helping anyone. But as you kind, yeah, as you kind of were navigating that, how did that go?
It went a lot better than I thought it would. I think, like I said earlier, there was some initial bumps when I started kind of saying no. But then when I was just kind of getting back to health and actually changing where my priorities lied and where my focus lied for being much more like still looking after people, still, you know, caring for people, but definitely not at my own detriment. And I think people respected me more. I think, and I actually felt very different towards people as well, which they probably picked up on, because I know that I definitely resented the fact that other people didn't do as much for me as I did for them. And as a helper, you're very good at tuning into people and knowing what their needs are, but not everyone is. But then you think, well, I can do it, so why can't they? And then even when they would offer help, I'd still say no because I couldn't accept help. So they were in a no-win situation. So it actually, I think, really helped my relationships, because I can accept help from other people, I can give help to people, but I'm also really looking after myself. So I'm in a good place when I'm doing things for people, rather than kind of doing it but being exhausted and almost resentful with them. So yeah, it's probably made most relationships stronger. All the ones that are worth keeping anyway.
And I think, you know, going back to what you were saying a little bit earlier, that the goal of this is you know, you still have some helper pattern, and you still, yeah, self-esteem is something that for all of us is kind of an ongoing kind of evolution in a sense. But it's also, you know, the goal of this is not to become someone that doesn't give a shit about anyone else. And it's just, yeah, like, I take care of me, you take care of you. That some of the greatest joys in my life have been doing things for others where I'm being helpful and I'm supporting, and not always in an equal exchange. Not that, well, you know, someone's paying me for a consultation, so I will be helpful because they're paying me, or this person in my life that I have a responsibility, so I have to do it. But the kind of open-heartedness of loving giving and loving caring for and helping and supporting people. And sometimes one gets paid in a professional context, other times one doesn't. Sometimes it's a role, sometimes it's just the right thing to do. But say a bit about the kind of the joy of being a helper, but in a way which is sustainable and is also taking care of yourself.
Yeah, I guess so. Before, like I said, I definitely felt drained by doing it. But now, yeah, it is just a pure joy. And I'm not doing it to get something back. Like, I'm not doing it because I need their love. I'm not doing it because I need their approval. I'm doing it because I actually really enjoy it. And I enjoy seeing people happy. And that's a really nice place to be. And I think so often, working with clients, when we talk about like helper patterns, achiever patterns, they're kind of like, well, I don't want to get rid of them. And that's not obviously what we're trying to do. It's just getting it into a balance where it's not at the detriment of yourself. And to be able to do that, to do something that I love doing, helping people in personal and professional life, but actually still be really well myself and not feeling drained by it and exhausted by it, it's really nice. It's really refreshing, after years of feeling like I was kind of running myself ragged to get that.
And of course, the irony is that the more that one takes care of themselves, the more, yes, they can actually help at scale, because you can sustain doing that. I also think it might be helpful as we kind of start to kind of wrap this up a little bit to touch on a bit of, we started with a bit about the general principles of your recovery story. Mm. As we've talked about the helper, maybe say a bit about, as you evolved in this pattern, how that related then back to your recovery, like any of the stepping stones or milestones or ways that it impacted upon, you know, either kind of getting better at pacing or getting better at taking care of yourself. But yeah, like how did this, beyond being something that I'm sure people can identify is super important for living a healthy, happy kind of life, how did it impact upon your recovery process?
I guess initially in bouncing the boundaries, it was so helpful, because I would always do too much so to please other people, and then I'd crash for days. And you can go through that cycle over and over and over again. And I did for a little while, because I wanted to keep other people happy. I wanted to do the things they wanted me to do. When I started getting a bit of energy, I remember people being really excited, like, oh, you can come and do this again, and you can come and do this. And I would, knowing that I couldn't handle it. But I wanted to keep everyone happy because they were happy that I could do things again. And if I'd have continued down that route, I'd probably still be kind of booming and busting and not quite getting there. So yeah, realizing that actually I needed to put myself first, and that yes, they might be disappointed that I couldn't come out, but if they're really, if they really cared about me, they'd understand. And actually, if I spent the time getting myself well, I can then consistently spend time with these people rather than kind of dipping in and then having a month to recover. And yeah, so it made me more consistently available to them.
And of course, that's one of the things I think that's so important here, isn't it? That it's one can see how the helper pattern can cause someone to crash with fatigue in the first place, because they're endlessly using up energy they don't have and burning themselves out. But it can also be, sometimes it's not always the question of what caused someone to get sick,
yeah,
what's stopping them from getting well. And if each time as energy is coming back and the body is on a recovery path, one keeps giving out their energy to everyone else, then they keep, as you were describing, they keep crashing back down again. And until you break that pattern, recovery can't really happen, because it just, the energy keeps going into others rather than into one's own body and one's own healing process. Yeah. As a kind of final question, what would you say to someone that's watching this or listening to this, who is really resonating with what we're talking about and going, oh my God, like this is the story of my life. Like you are describing me, and it's thinking, but this just feels overwhelming. Like, this is who I am. Like, you're asking me to change who I am as a person. That seems impossible.
Yeah.
What would you say to someone that feels that way?
Yeah. So first of all, it's not about changing who you are. Like, I am still a massive helper. I wouldn't be doing this job if I didn't want to help people. My friends and family know that I'm always there to support, but I'm always there to support as long as it's not at my detriment. So yeah, it's not about changing who you are. And also for me, it was instrumental having a practitioner help me kind of guide me through it, because I saw the achiever pattern and I thought, yeah, I can handle that. I'm working my way through it. And then I saw the helper and it felt really deeply ingrained in me. So I needed the help to just kind of navigate that, to ease it off. And it's not about doing it all at once. It can be really, really gradual, and just chipping away and just putting a bit of boundaries in one place of your life and then at another. And I think the other thing of navigating it on your recovery path is that each stage of recovery kind of gives you a different challenge with it. So very much stage one, it was easy to say no. Stage two, it was kind of people's expectations of what I could do. Stage three, it was then more kind of work things. So I had responsibilities to people at work, expectations on me that I wouldn't want to let people down. So again, just knowing that, I think we can often think as helpers, if we say no to something, the world might fall apart.
Yes.
So really looking at that and looking at your thought patterns around that. And then now as someone kind of recovered, there's a whole other element to it, because yeah, I'm, you know, back in the world, and it would be easy to kind of not have those boundaries now because I've got energy. But actually, I really like those boundaries. They keep me well, they keep me happy. But it's not about doing it all at once. It's kind of working with where you are at the time.
Well, so, I think it's that thing of what you're saying as well around what you're responsible for, right? Because I think a helper will tend to make themselves responsible for everyone and everything.
Yeah.
And sometimes we have to remember that we're not everyone's responsible for their own life. And sometimes there are people in positions who, they're for whatever reason, not able to be self-responsible. But fundamentally, we're responsible for ourselves. And yes, being a loving, kind, good person, but that doesn't mean taking responsibility for everyone else. You know, one of the big lessons for me over the years, particularly in running Optimum Health Clinic, when there's inevitably various dramas and temporary crises and things that happen, is that my old response used to be, well, I've got to fix all of this now and I've got to know the answer, I've got to figure it out. And then you kind of discover a few times that you spend all night trying to solve a problem, and then the next morning it's fixed itself because for whatever reason. And there's this kind of thing that you start to build, I think, more trust that, yes, sometimes you have to engage with an issue and you have to find a way to deal with something. But often other people will step up and other pieces will get resolved. And sometimes the crisis is simply that there's a terrible kind of snowstorm and people can't get to London for an event. And the next day the snow's gone and it's like, you don't need to solve the problem. So there's a kind of, there's a trust, I guess, this is the other piece, perhaps we didn't fully touch on, there's this trust that kind of builds. That's really what I think you were speaking to here. There's a kind of trust that you don't have to be responsible for everyone. You're responsible for yourself and to do the best you can, but not carrying that kind of weight of everyone on your shoulders.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And the more, and it's trusting in yourself. It's trusting that the world won't fall apart. And it's trusting in other people as well, that actually other people have resources. And if you kind of back away and allow them to find them, they do. And I think we can often feel like we need to look after people because they'll fall apart otherwise. But often when we kind of give them space, it allows them to grow. And that was definitely a learn on my journey as well. I think helpers can almost enable people to not stand on their own two feet sometimes. Whereas if we move away, they find they can.
And if what's happening is we're attracting kind of energy vampires, the people are just abusing our kind of helper side, we're not the first helper they found. We're not the last one they're going to find. When you have those really toxic relationships, you do just have to put up a boundary and you have to step away. And almost by definition of the very physics of how this works, that person will just go and find someone else and they'll play out the same pattern. But when we're feeding someone else through us constantly helping and them constantly taking, we're not actually helping them. We're just perpetuating a cycle. And it's like that thing of, you give a man a fish for a day, you feed him for a day. If you teach him how to fish, you feed him for a lifetime. Well, you're just going to end up having to feed that fish every day. Yes. And actually, it's far better. It's more supportive to that person and us to put up that boundary and say, I don't do this anymore. I can't do this anymore. We need to stop. You know, I wish you luck to find another way forward. And that takes a courage, but it really goes back to what you were saying earlier, that it's having enough self-love and self-respect and self-worth to be able to put that boundary up.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's tough, but it's rewarding when you get there, definitely. And there's lots of little rewards on the way as well.
Yeah. Gemma, thank you so much. I think that's been a really helpful, input for people. And I think it's one that a lot of people are going to resonate with. And thank you also for being courageous enough to talk about it from the kind of lens of your story. So thank you very much.
Thank you.